a final judgment in the case. So I know there was a summary judgment as to who the trustee was in his case in the fall of 2003. The final judgment in the case was not entered until, I think, January of 2006. June 2006. So he couldn't appeal that summary judgment that was issued 3 years ago until just recently.
So if I can summarize your suggestions to this committee, number one is we ought to have juries involved earlier. And second, we ought to have more than just one judge ruling on motions for summary judgment.
Yes. And
do you have any other suggestions that this committee can consider for improving the system?
I do, real quickly.
Okay.
I think with respect to court appointees in the probate courts, in trust litigation, when you have people who are appointed and who are going to be hiring lawyers, spending money, taking the assets of a trust and using those assets, I think that those court appointees need to put up some sort of bond or security so that to the extent they are paid before any kind of final judgment, before any kind of final decision determining whether there has been a benefit to the estate, there is money available to return if somebody later finds that their actions were inappropriate or that they should have been paid less than what they've actually been paid. I can't emphasize enough because it was one of the constant battles in our case. I believe that these people have to show a measurable benefit to the estate that they're representing. It's not a question of them coming into court and saying, I billed 20 hours and here's my rate for every hour I spend on this case. And so therefore, and I say it's reasonable, and so therefore I get my 20 times $200. And I think there is a tendency to accept that kind of logic. And for example, with this trustee, she was charging her legal rates as a lawyer for all of her actions as a, quote, receiver. She hired her law firm from the get-go, immediately, to help her to administer this trust estate. And they were being paid for reviewing pleadings, but she wasn't even in the litigation. I mean, they were doing things that lawyers do, but she wasn't even involved in the litigation at that point. Judge Wood mentioned that he scrutinizes these bills that are presented to him for approval on an interim basis. You know, I was involved in several of these fee applications, not only by the receiver, but by others as well. I never saw a single dime disapproved for any of those court appointees. I objected to many of those applications. The receiver case, for example, I was not permitted, once I started asking the receiver about her handling of the stock portfolio, my cross-examination was stopped. I was told to stop cross-examining her about that. We would not go into that. And at the end of the day, well, you know the result. I appreciate the opportunity. I know this has been a long day for you guys, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear.
Appreciate your being here, Mr. Hardy. Chair calls Gus Tamborello.
Tamborello.
Is it Tam or Tan?
Tamborello.
Tam, T-A-M.
Good afternoon.
Senator, want to pull that mic around?
I'm Gus Tamborello from Houston, Texas. I'm a probate attorney. I was a 1987 graduate of the University of Houston Law School, and I've been practicing in Harris County and the surrounding counties almost all of my career. I was a member and have been a member of the probate section of the State Bar, and in fact have worked on the committee this year that's submitting to the legislature suggestions for changes in the guardianship code. However, there were some recent developments, and I felt compelled to be here today, and I'm really glad that I was here this morning, because you have heard such blatant misrepresentations about what the probate code says for people who don't practice probate that I feel compelled to make a statement. First of all, I realize the nature and the scope of the charge. and I want to keep my remarks to that. But I want to state, first of all, that under 665, which seems to have been the most popular section touted today, having to do with compensation of guardians, that section does not need to be changed. I do not agree with the $50 an hour suggestion, with all due respect to Judge Herman. The fact of the matter is, this statute sets out that, first of all, it starts out, the court may authorize compensation. You already have given the judge discretion whether to or not. It gives a judge the formula by which to work with. And it lets any interested person or the court on its own motion to review the compensation. So in each of the four courts that I can speak for in Harris County, we file itemized bills, whether we're serving as the attorney for the applicant, whether we're serving as the guardian, whether we're serving as an ad litem, whether it be guardian ad litem or attorney ad litem. We file detailed fee applications that are scrutinized by the courts. And if found to be inappropriate, they're cut. The statute already says the court may deny any fee authorized under this section in whole or in part, and it goes on to state the reasons. And it says a guardian, if they haven't adequately performed their duties, their fee can be denied. These courts review, they have particular staff members. Their staffs are larger than every district court. They have particular staff members that review these bills. And they are routinely cut, and a lot of times the attorneys know what they can and can't bill for. And so if you bill for taking a ward to the doctor and you bill your rate, well, it might be cut. But as Judge Wood said earlier with the example of a bank, I will tell you right now, as scary as it may seem, there are banks in this state where their personnel do not even know what a letter of guardianship is. In fact, sometimes they look at you like you're robbing the bank when you go in there. Not only do they demand that I be there as the court-appointed guardian, they want to see the court order appointing me. And a lot of times we're appointed, or our client is appointed. We order the letter of guardianship, which is essentially your marching order, and you go present it. And they want to see more than that. Sometimes the guardian, if they're the attorney, is still required to do certain things. So I hesitate, and it makes me very nervous to follow Judge Herman's suggestion about saying, well, it's got to be legal services. Guess what, folks? It already is. We only get paid for doing legal services, and that's what 666 says. It's already in here. As Judge Wood said, this is one of the finest guardianship codes around. It addresses things from start to finish. And I want to say,
let me just respectfully recall some of the testimony we've heard earlier today. The complaint is that although you may not have been paid for anything but legal services, other lawyers and other cases have been paid the legal rate for non-legal services. And that's the complaint. And that's what people have been testifying today that they'd like fixed.
Well, and here's the problem with what a lot of people have testified to today. They all had the opportunity to object. And you know what 665 gives them? It says, on an application of any interested person or on the court's own motion, they can review the compensation. And another very grave inaccuracy by counsel who admitted that he wasn't a probate lawyer was about whether or not you can address the issue of guardian accountings at the end of the case. And in fact, Professor Johansson from this great city and a professor at University of Houston Law School cites right in under Section 749 the probate code. This is a Deporta Nova case. The probate code requires strict responsibility and accountability by a guardian for the period of the guardianship and does not excuse older transactions for reasons of convenience. Thus, previous accountings can be reexamined on final accounting, even if prior accountings were approved by the court. We already have the law that says that. So you've got people coming up here and saying, legislature, you need to change these things. There is no need to change it. It's here.
Okay,
there is accountability.
Let me ask you, since you are more intimately familiar with the probate code than some other witnesses we've had today, what changes do you believe need to be made by this legislature in the next regular session to improve the probate code?
As I said earlier, Senator, I was part of a committee that is submitting some recommendations through our real estate and probate section. And those I don't have in front of me, but those will be submitted in due course. With respect, though, to the issue of fiduciary oversight, my recommendation is really to make – there is no change necessary as far as the compensation section is concerned because it's already addressed in the statute. That's the short answer. But if the panel would indulge me for just a few more moments, one thing that's been sorely overlooked today is the fact that where is the responsibility of these parties who come in and bring these contested matters? They are the ones who initiate these things and require ad litems to be appointed. In every one of these cases, it was a contested matter.
Not
and
in some of them. Not in Mrs. Taub's case.
Right. Ms. Taub is an exception, Senator. I agree with you.
Ms. Taub is an exception. These people had contested right. cases that
But
they
in Ms. Taub, you weren't dealing with an attorney ad litem situation. It was an independent administration, and you were dealing with a court-appointed appraiser. And I believe the change made by the legislature requiring good cause was a good one. But the fact of the matter is you don't – I can't remember an independent administration in all the years I've practiced where any of the probate judges required an appraisal. This was one instance that came out, and in fact, because it was something that caused a lot of people to be upset about, and because there was some merit to changing or tweaking that language, we did it. And I think that problem is fixed. But what we have here is a really very small number of people who are disgruntled and who run to the media or who run to a committee like this and say, oh, we have this horrible, broken problem. We don't. It's a beautiful system. It works. It works well. But what happens is, you get into contested matters, and as Judge Wood said, I believe 90% or more, maybe 95-98% of all probate matters are not contested. And the attorney's fees are reasonable. Well, why is that? Because there is no contest going on. Daddy has died. Mama wants to go probate Daddy's will. I feel bad about what happened to Miss Taub. I don't like that she had to be put through that, but that's an aberration. And that is not what happens on a routine basis. And, you know, you have folks that come in and want to change the law based on a specific case that had specific facts that were really limited to that particular case. And what bothers me is we never make good decisions based on emotion. You know, that's why, you know, you shouldn't, you know, have a gun nearby. You know, if you're having an argument with somebody, we don't want to place people in a situation where we do major things while we're in a state of anger or excitement or whatever. We do stupid things when we do that. And what happens in these cases is you have litigants who don't like the result. And most of the time, it was their own actions that led to the result. Coming down and complaining and want to change the law when 98% of the people are not affected by it, where 98% of the people get through the system without any problem. And Judge Wood is correct about the decedent side of Texas probate. It's got to be one of the most inexpensive in the nation. People are really surprised at how easy it can be. And in guardianship, well, we've got a nice thing right in here called the Durable Power of Attorney Act. You know, a person in this state can write a durable power of attorney over their finances and over their health care, and guess what? They don't ever have to go through guardianship. But what happens when one of two siblings shoves a power of attorney under Mama when she may not have her mental capacity, when Mama had already named one of her other siblings as the power of attorney? Well, what happens then? The bank won't honor it because I've got two competing powers of attorney. The doctor doesn't want to honor it because they're scared to death. Which one of you has authority? So guess where it ends up? In probate court. And so there have to be ad litems appointed because somebody has to figure out what is in the best interest of this person and who is most qualified, if either, to serve. You get third-party attorneys. Why, Senator? Because either the family members are disqualified or they're unsuitable. or they can't get along, and so a court has to put a third party in charge to handle the affairs. I've been appointed that way. There's hundreds of people appointed. You would think by hearing this testimony today that there's about a handful of lawyers in Harris County that are just names, or it's like a printing press of appointments. That's just false. That is false, because every attorney, as the judge says, he has got to be confident that the person he appoints is qualified to do the job. Of course, these gentlemen would love first-year lawyers or our social workers to be guardians, so we could run roughshod over them. We don't want an experienced lawyer. God help us if we have an experienced lawyer as an ad litem. You know, we might actually have to answer for our conduct. And that's what experienced ad litems do. They bring to the court's attention problems, and they're bound by their ethical duty. They have to have every dime of their fee approved. This code already allows scrutiny. This code, in fact, has a section that says that the judge is supposed to look under Section 602 at less restrictive alternatives. Well, we have two beautiful ones in the state of Texas called a durable power of attorney and a medical power of attorney. Now, that prevents guardianships, period, unless, why? Abuse. Somebody gets mom to sign it when she didn't have capacity. Somebody decides, I want control over the estate. And when you have a living, breathing human being, this person that's incapacitated, it's their money. I heard one gentleman say, well, somebody has to protect the money for this person and their heirs. No, no, sir, not for their heirs. For mama and daddy, not for your heirs. A will takes effect when they die. Heirships are had when they die. It's mama's money, not you, daughter, not you, son. You can fight all you want over control. And the judges see both sides. And I'd like the committee to understand this. What you see on the news is not both sides of the story. It's the disgruntled one, the one who lost. And you don't hear the evidence on both sides. And so what happens is, if you're well-financed, you can continue to complain. You can move to Arizona and then try to change Texas law if you have the money. That's not what we need to be doing. There is a section I'd like to point out that maybe we want to put some teeth into, and a little more teeth. It's Section 622 called Security for Costs.
Mr. Tamburello, since you brought up that particular case, let me ask you, do you think it's appropriate for us to have a situation exist in Texas where all the beneficiaries of the trusts oppose litigation and want to fire the trustee, but the trustee is allowed to continue a lawsuit that lasts over several years and has apparently looted a $3.5 million asset? Does that sound fair to you?
No,
I mean, I'm not a judge, and I haven't heard both sides, but
Senator, it seems
to me there's something not quite right about a situation where all the beneficiaries unanimously say, we don't want to go through this litigation. And the trustee who they want to fire is given standing in court.
Right. Well,
what's fair about that?
Well, Senator, put in those terms, you know, neither you nor I have heard the other side of the story. We weren't sitting with the robe on hearing why this trustee may have had. The trustee, of course, is entitled to representation. Whether he or she did something wrong is for the court to decide.
But the trustee's attorney's fees are being paid out of the beneficiary's assets.
That's right.
And the beneficiaries don't want the litigation.
I understand.
Unanimously do not want the litigation.
Well, but what has to be examined is what are all of the facts to the situation? That's the thing that you and I don't know, and I'm not as versed on that case. All I heard was, I'm concerned about our Texas laws being changed because of somebody's disgruntled over a result in one case, or they're upset and really want to be vengeful about it and
Mr.
get the
Tamburello,
law changed.
That is not a good argument.
Yeah.
You just said that Mrs. Taub had a good argument, and we changed the law based on her case alone, and that was an improvement.
That I agree with you on that one.
Okay.
There's
a case that's brought to us. It's clearly unfair. I don't understand how a judge either, to be perfectly candid. I don't see how a judge can give to an unlicensed appraiser, approve a fee of nearly $80,000 when a licensed appraiser will do it for less than $10,000. I mean, that is too disproportionate to me. there's something not right here. And you don't have to be a lawyer or on the jurisprudence committee to figure that out.
I agree with you, Senator, but that the system in that case, the probate code has been tweaked to add the good cause language. I think that was a good change. But under the facts of that case, it went to the Court of Appeals, and then it came back, and then it went to a jury trial. And while on the subject of jury trials, I'm not sure what world the other counsel's living in, but if you pulled Section 21 of the probate code, it says, and I'll just read it, in all contested probate and mental illness proceedings in the district court, in the county court, or the statutory probate court, the county court at law, or any other statutory probate court exercising probate jurisdiction, the parties shall be entitled to a trial by jury as in all other civil cases. Juries at the beginning of a guardianship will demand one because it's allowed. Can you imagine every
time?
So
Mr. Hardy should have demanded one and didn't?
If the complaint is we don't have a system that allows for a jury to look at a contested issue, I believe that's an erroneous statement of the law based on Section 21 and based on the rules of civil procedure.
Okay.
Now, do
Senator
we need
Gallegos
a jury?
Senator Gallegos has a question for you.
Yes.
Mr. Tamberello, we've had several people testify up here. Ms. Taub, I don't know her, but I know of her family. Ms. Conti, I don't know her either. Mr. Alpert, I don't know him. And I will tell you, Ms. Taub, I know that my folks in my district is poor to moderate. If they get shot or in a bad car wreck and it's life or death, I'm going to Ben Taub Hospital. That's what they know. That's what they do know. Now, as far as what you said, that what's in law and these are disgruntled people, and I'll go back to my example of a little old lady on Avenue K. What if she has a case, but she didn't have the money to hire a high probate lawyer and all that, even though she might be right and she's not disgruntled? Let's say she is disgruntled, but we can't hear her because she didn't have the money to hire one of these lawyers that we've been talking about. Or the lawyer that gets picked by the judge, that's a trustee, you know, and if you're the same Tamberello family that I know of, in Houston, Texas, y'all are respected, especially in the fire department area, where I come from. But what I'm saying is that these people that you're not hearing from here that don't have a voice here today, that these people just come up here and on their own time. And obviously they're disappointed and they're frustrated and they're disgruntled. And I've heard that in their testimony. They have a right, just like that lady that I represent down the street has a right, if she has the money. Some of them don't have the money. We don't hear their stories. We don't hear their stories. But I bet you a million to one, it might not be the money amount, but it's the same that they feel just as strong about their case as the poor lady down the street that doesn't have the money to hire one of these lawyers that gets picked a trustee. And let me give you an example, my own case. It really wasn't my own. My father had meso cancer, okay? I wasn't even in the legislature. I was still in the fire department. Didn't know about meso specialist attorneys that can get you the world and all this. I didn't care. All I cared is about my loved one. That's all I did. And then later on, to get in the legislature, and lo and behold, you got a sea of experts that could have got you, could have gotten not me, but my mother, 20 times the amount. That we didn't care about amount of money. All we cared is about his care. We didn't care about money. That never entered into the formula, just, you know, taking care of my father in his last days on this earth. And I think that the chairman is right. You know, I mean, I hear what you're saying as far as law and all that. These people have voices like anybody else. And quite frankly, they put it. Their testimony has been thorough and specific and to the point. And if I was in the jury, not knowing any of them, you know, I'd probably vote their way. You know, I'm just saying that, I'm not a lawyer. I just call it like I see them, you know, I mean, Your zeal is well taken on the law, and I understand your specifics, and there's case and case, and that's good. But these people, you know, the testimony that I've heard, the chairman's saying all we're looking is for recommendations.
Right.
And you're saying that, you know, whatever the recommendations you have, you know, I haven't heard nothing that is going to satisfy these people that have testified before us.
Well, Senator, if I may respond, first of all, to your person on Avenue K, if her husband died and needed to probate a will, there's lawyers who will probate that will for free in Harris County. The question is, does that client of yours need the probate system? And if they do, we have a program in Harris County, if she's indigent, called the Harris County Guardianship Program, where if a person is indigent, they can have the guardianship program appointed their guardian. And one thing that's been overlooked, because we've been talking about fees and everybody's complaining about fees, you know, you take the good with the bad. As a court-appointed lawyer, and granted, my practice isn't limited. It's limited to probate and guardianship. But a lot of times I'm representing the disgruntled person who's filing the application because one of their siblings is trying to take advantage of mama. I'm a lot of times in the person whose action is necessitating the appointment of an ad litem. But some of the times I am that ad litem. And some of the times I am that guardian. And guess what? It is the person, not even as rich as the lady on Avenue K, and I mean that not disrespectfully, but they have nothing. And I serve for free. A lot of us do. And the understanding is it's not in this code, because everybody wants to look at, well, look how much this lawyer made in this case. What we have to look at is the judges know that if it happened to be a case where it was you were appointed the administrator and there was money in there to pay you, your fees were approved, and it was one of those where you didn't have to take a hit on, that you might get one later where the person has no money. I've got one right now, a lady in Deer Park, her son, who has a serious drug problem, took over her house. She's in a nursing home. They were about to throw her out. She owed $11,000. Medicaid is expecting the house to be sold because under the Medicaid law, if you own this asset and you have no intent to return to the house, it doesn't belong to the kids. That's what's so frustrating to hear. It belongs to mama. But guess what? We have to sell that. And I've been working essentially, you know, for next to nothing, because I have to take the action as her guardian and get her house sold, get her bills paid. And if at the end of the day, I may or may not get paid. And, you know, the problem with putting numbers and splashing them on the TV camera is a lot of times you are never paid. The court might approve certain fees in a case, and based on the standards set forth in the code, the judges routinely will approve fees they find to be reasonable, but the estate has to be able to support it. So you don't get into situations where if there's no money to pay the lawyer, they are not paid. This code says that the county can pay the lawyer at a reduced rate is what happens if there is no fee.
I'm not here, you know, to debate you, but wouldn't you agree with me, if you've heard this testimony that I've heard, whether you're right or whether they're right, okay, you're citing law, and I understand that, but wouldn't you agree with me that after testimony that I've heard, okay, I don't know if you were here, if you heard their testimony, that, you know, we got a problem. We have a problem. Regardless of if it's etched in stone, we still have some kind of a problem here.
I respectfully disagree, Senator, because there's, in each one of these cases, aside from Ms. Taub's case, you had a contested matter, a family dispute, or a lawsuit that by its nature, of course, is a contest. And that's what lawyers do, is they put on their armor and they go represent the client. What happens, though, later down the road is the clients and realize that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have brought this in the first place. Or maybe if we'd have sat down at the kitchen table and talked about which one of us should be mama's guardian, then we wouldn't have had a contested guardianship. Maybe if I haven't shoved that power of attorney in front of mama and had her sign it when she'd already given it to her son 6 months before her other son, maybe we wouldn't have a guardianship. Maybe if we didn't have a society that abused the elderly, neglected the elderly, or had a lot of greed among the family where they invoke the jurisdiction of the probate court, we wouldn't have this. That's why I brought up the Durable Power of Attorney Act. A lot of cases never get to probate. Your lady on Avenue K, if she wanted a power of attorney to avoid guardianship, you give her my name. I'll be happy to do one if she's indigent. Because there are ways around this. And what I'm saying is we have a code that's wonderful, and it addresses it. Are there people that are upset about results? Of course there are.
Thank you.
I'm sure that there's litigants in district court every day that are upset. But their fees don't have to be approved by the judge.
Mr. Tamborello, I think we've got the message from you that we've got a great probate code. It doesn't need any changing.
Well,
we've got four more witnesses that would like to testify, and it would be my personal preference that we get people out of here before the rush hour, which is going to start in about an hour.
Well, I will say, Senator, again, that I was part of the committee that recommended some changes.
Right.
And they will be before the court. I don't have this before me, but based upon the nature of the charge today, I think the code already addresses those issues. So thank you very much.
I appreciate your being here. Okay. The chair calls Russell Verney. Appreciate your patience. I think you've been here all day, Mr. Verney. If you'd introduce yourself and tell us who you represent.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Russell Verney. I live at 6812 Summer Meadow Lane in Dallas, Texas. I'm here representing myself today. I am certainly disgruntled, but I am not embittered. And I am not somebody who has been a victim of the system. In fact, I worked for 5 years for an organization called Judicial Watch. And citizens from throughout the state of Texas contacted us with numerous complaints about their experiences in probate court. And I understand when somebody loses, they don't like it. But after looking into some of these cases, it was eye-opening. I think you're hearing a little bit of it today, but this is just the tip of it. Let me begin with the opportunity today to comment on the oversight of fiduciaries appointed by the courts. And to me, the key word there is appointed. About a year ago, there was a judge over in Bryant who was forced to resign. About a week to 10 days later, there was a news article in the paper by one of his colleagues. His colleagues had appointed him to a lucrative position representing a client. And the colleague who was the appointer was reported in the newspaper as saying, "I knew he, the former judge, the appointee, needed the work, needed the income." Well, Mr. Chairman, I would submit that this is not about the appointer or the appointee. It's about the appointment. And we have all these titles we've heard about today of administrator and guardian and trustee and executor and everything under the sun, ad litems, guardian ad litems, attorney ad litems. Where do these appointments come from? As I inquired around the state, I find that each judge keeps his own secret list. Many of them will share it with you, but it's his list. How did somebody get on there? The judge put them on it. In what order are they selected? We all like the ability of random assignment of cases in courts to avoid forum shopping. But here we've got the reverse. Instead of attorneys shopping for the judge, we have the judge who now chooses which attorney will become a participant in an adversarial case that's to be adjudicated by that judge. Now, I'm only a lonely activist, not a well-educated person. But as a member of the public, one of the prongs that is looked at when you're talking about recusals, I can't help but think there's an inherent bias when the judge, off of his own personal list, has selected a person to to be an advocate in front of him. I think it's inherently obvious that if the other party asks for a recusal, it should be granted. If there are going to be appointments, the judges should specify what the requirements are to be appointed. For instance, in the Conti case, they needed to appoint somebody as a trustee to do an accounting. They did not appoint a CPA. They appointed an MBA. In many of the cases, we've heard about the thousands of cases that go through probate courts, and they do. They don't have attorneys as administrators, guardians, or any other position, except by accident when one is in the family. It seems only when we get into the family that's in difficulty, comes to the court for help, and the court then appoints somebody that we wind up with difficulties. For instance, Harris County, over the 11 years in Mr. Epstein's report, handled 8,875 dockets of guardianship cases. And in your report there, you'll see that only 138 of those 8,875 accounted for all for about 50% of all guardianship fees. So the fees are going into very few cases. And in fact, they're going to very few people. In that same report that you have from Mr. Epstein, you'll see that in Harris County over 11 years, 56% of all guardianship fees went to 30 attorneys. 30 attorneys over 11 years out of 8,875 cases, 56% of the money, and I believe this figure is over $60 million total, 56% of that money went to 30 attorneys. They weren't randomly selected for their assignments based upon qualifications. They were selected for their assignments based upon their relationship with the judge. Again, I believe that that's an inherent conflict, should be an immediate recusal when asked for. Could be avoided, and here's my recommendation, Mr. Chairman. Every county has a county clerk's office. Let the judges specify the qualifications they want for various positions and announce that the public can sign up for them. Why do we need a lawyer to be a guardian? No reason they can't be a guardian, but why do we need them to be a guardian? Every guardian under the statute that I can see is entitled to hire a lawyer. And if you appoint a lawyer, in many cases, Mr. Epstein pointed out, they hire a lawyer. So we don't need a lawyer to be in that position. So announce to the public that they could serve in these positions. And there may be lots of people who do it voluntarily, but certainly a lot cheaper than attorney's fees. And I disagree with the previous spokesperson about they charge legal fees only for legal work. If you look on tab 6, page 39 of Mr. Epstein's report, you'll see that the previous speaker was charging fees for things that aren't legal work. He was charging legal fees. I think you'll find that in the case of the Conti family, somebody was receiving $20,000 minimum. Minimum of $20,000 a month, every month for 7 years. What value are they bringing? As Ms. Conti pointed out at the end, she understood there was a conflict that was never disclosed to the participants in the case. That in fact, that judge and the appointed trustee earning over $20,000 minimum a month were co-authors of documents, and in fact, she served as his campaign treasurer. But Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem with contributions. I believe in disclosure. And I believe, like previous testimony, that the laws regarding probate in Texas are very good. I believe the application of them is very poor in instances. Same with the campaign finance. The judicial branch of our state government could take one meager step forward that would resolve a problem like Ms. Conti's, simply by keeping a disclosure of their own campaign finance reports in their courtroom. Keep in mind, those are public records someplace, but the public doesn't know where to find them, or how to find them, or even that they exist. Keep them available so that there's more disclosure in cases like that. But when the recusal is asked for, a judge has the opportunity either to accept the recusal or refer. Obviously, if a judge refers, it indicates to the judge's colleagues that he doesn't want off the case. He wants to stay on, he or she wants to stay on the case. If that's the case, you can't be referring it to somebody that that individual is working with day in and day out in the same building to ask them whether or not the judge that doesn't want to be recused should or shouldn't be recused. I agree with many of the recommendations made earlier with respect to recusal. I would simply take it one step further and say that the person brought in to hear the recusal should be outside the district.
So you would disagree with the idea of having the regional administrative judge be the one that would assign a new judge?
The regional administrative judge is fine to do it because, as I understand it, Mr. Chairman, and I could be very wrong, a regional administrative judge covers more than one district. And, for instance, in Harris County, the county and the district are one and the same,
right,
geographically. Other places, they're not the same geographically, but you have county courts at law co-located in the building where there are district courts.
Right.
So rather than have the district court judge in that same building with the county court at law hearing it, have somebody from outside the district hear it, so that the public gets and this, I believe, is one of the prongs, is that the public has the belief that there's a fair and impartial hearing going on. And it's not about the judge being able to stay in the case, it's whether or not a fair and impartial hearing has taken place that's critical importance. There's also the federal statute on recusal, which I'll leave for the committee just for their edification, if in the event you do care to do anything with recusal. But my belief is simply assign a judge outside the district, and I believe the public will feel a lot better about their treatment in it. With respect to the review of payments, a particular staff member, I believe, was testified to on a judge's staff is there to review the payments. I believe the legislature created that position and funded that position. I would suggest, though, since the judge is appointing these people off of his own private list based on his own criteria for them, and now he's having the bill reviewed by his staff and handed to him for review, I think we should just take temptation out of it. Let the review of that bill be done by the county auditor's office. They already exist. They audit bills. I happened to be in court one day when a bill for over $530,000 was submitted. The attorney testified, and attested, I believe is the word, that all of those were reasonable and necessary charges. $530,000 plus. And you were not able to challenge any one of the individual payments. I think someplace in there, my wife would have found an error. She would have got a reduction someplace. So let's take it out of the in-house club, out of the cottage industry that has grown up around the specialized court, move it out one more step politically so that the county auditor's office looks through them for reasonable and necessary charges on bills before the court has a hearing and rules on them. Otherwise, there's no value to that staff person who's sitting in the court. In the Condi case, Ms. Condi pointed out a situation where the trust document was changed by the court. I don't know the law. I don't pretend to know the law, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do know there was an argument presented that the court didn't have authority to change a trust document. The court represented it did. It's on appeal. So later this year, you will probably have an indication, at least from one of the appeals courts in Houston, of that situation. But I would like to point out, for public policy considerations by this committee, I was contacted by a person who expressed to me that a dear friend of his had passed away. He had decreed that his assets be used to help small charities. And let me, if I might, Mr. Chairman, very brief, read the wording of what the successor trustees, according to this man who accumulated all this wealth, put it in trust. He said that in the event of his death or disability, the trusteeship for any trust created from the trust estate shall be self-perpetuating, and following my death or disability, there shall at all times be three trustees for each trust. And here's where he says about appointing trustees, he says, except that an individual whose profession is related to financial services, including without limitation, law school graduates, regardless of whether or not he or she is a practicing or has ever practiced law or has been admitted to the bar, bankers, investment bankers, stockbrokers, investment advisors, trust company owners, or employees of trust offices shall not be eligible for appointment as a trustee. Pretty clear. I mean, I'm not a rocket scientist, but that's pretty clear what his intent was. Mm-hmm. If I could indulge you for just 1 second, Mr. Chairman, I will read what happened as it came out of court. I don't want to get into the merits of the decision, but I think as a public policy matter, this committee needs to discuss whether or not somebody's intentions need to be honored after death. Whereas this person, Murphy H. Baxter, has been determined to be partially incapacitated pursuant to proceedings in the Harris County Court, now therefore the guardian hereby amends and restates the Declaration of Trust in its entirety as set forth below, and in consideration of the acceptance by Frost National Bank as trustee of the trust governed by Murphy H. Baxter. The guardian was an attorney too, but that wasn't accepted in the trust document, but the bankers were specifically said they don't want them to do it. As a matter of public policy for the citizens of the state of Texas, what is the life of the language a grantor puts into a trust document? I think that's an appropriate...
One would hope it's permanent.